Paper 7. All right, at the beginning. Page, old single column, page 81. So, I don't think we really need any preface again this time, since we're actually going to read a preface. How appropriate is that? You know, just going to continue right on. You know, we noticed a while back that the Divine Council here has constructed this very similar to the way the first five papers are constructed. You know, sort of the same sequence of topics, and so you know, here you are in relation to the universe. So let's just jump in. We'll see that in short order, all kinds of mother words pop up.
Paper 7, Relation of the Eternal Son to the Universe. The original Son is ever concerned with the execution of the spiritual aspects of the Father's eternal purpose as it progressively unfolds in the phenomena of the evolving universes with their manifold groups of living beings. We do not fully comprehend this eternal plan, but the Paradise Son undoubtedly does. The Son is like the Father in that he seeks to bestow everything possible of himself upon his coordinate sons and upon their subordinate sons. And the Son shares the Father's self-distributive nature in the unstinted bestowal of himself upon the Infinite Spirit, their conjoint executive.
Amy, just one little thing. That word self-distributive, you remember when we talked about the sevenfold in greater detail and we were going through total deity, they used that word relative to the sevenfold. Distributive deity. And, in relation to, I shouldn't say it that way. I shouldn't just say it directly like that. But, the self-distributive deity of the universal creator, okay, you know, technically that's self-distributive deity, the creature identified deity, that's literally the sevenfold. And my point was that those are in the same functional level, you know, they're tied to that. So, when you're thinking about that self-distributive, you start out, like they say, with the Infinite Spirit, and then you're on your way down the sevenfold. And so, the fact that there's that sort of is kind of being suggested right away at the beginning, is important because we're gonna be seeing how they're going to be invoking that sort of downreach of that mother-like presence coming down in parallel to the sevenfold. All right. Oh, yeah.
In the first paragraph, mm-hmm. Why do they mention that the Paradise Son undoubtedly understands the execution of the spiritual aspects of the Father's eternal purpose? What about the Creative Mother Spirit? Doesn't she understand it too?
No. That's the Paradise Son, the Eternal Son. Okay,
as the upholder of spirit realities, the second source and center is the eternal counterpoise of the Isle of Paradise, which so magnificently upholds all things material. Thus is the first source and center forever revealed in the material beauty of the exquisite patterns of the central isle, and in the spiritual values of the supernal personality of the Eternal Son. The Eternal Son is the actual upholder of the vast creation of spirit realities and spiritual beings. The spirit world is the habit, the personal conduct of the Son, and the impersonal realities of the spirit nature are always responsive to the will and purpose of the perfect personality of the Absolute Son. The Son is not, however, personally responsible for the conduct of all spirit personalities. The will of the personal creature is relatively free and hence determines the actions of such volitional beings. Therefore, the free will spirit world is not always truly representative of the character of the Eternal Son, even as nature on Urantia is not truly revelatory of the perfection and immutability of paradise and deity. But no matter what may characterize the free will action of man or angel, the Son's eternal grasp of the universal gravity control of all spirit realities continues as absolute.
Okay, so let's back up there a little bit. You know, and as you started reading, I thought, let's just go ahead and let's just flip back. If you go back to page 2, when they're at the functional levels of total deity, just so you can see that directly. That fourth functional level, the creativity of deity, you see self-distributive and divinely revealed deity. Self-distributive deity, that's the universal creator. And then divinely revealed deity, they were just, invoking that direct connection there with the Father's self-distributive nature as the universal creator, is the unstinted bestowal of himself upon the infinite spirit, their conjoint actor, divinely revealed deity is the spirit. See, so you have that direct connection between self-distributive deity and divinely revealed deity, between the universal creator and the spirit. Hopefully, I'm kind of muddling it. I hope that's clear. So that's the direct connection. But immediately, what follows that is that evolutional level where you have the creature identified deity, the sevenfold. So they're, by saying that self-distributive, that's a word that's very tightly tied to this particular statement right here at the beginning of the foreword about the functional levels. So that for the reader who's noticing that fine a detail, they are invoking that moving out from the Father and the Son through the Spirit, and into the sevenfold, coming down, Father, Son, Spirit down the sevenfold. Okay, so that's what I was attempting to say there. So as soon as they did that, notice what they did next. Immediately you see as the upholder, you see the word upholder. And you know that's a word that's tied, essentially to the mother. As you're, heading down in parallel to the sevenfold, and we talk about those levels of the mother as being various levels of upholding, and it's all rooted in the infinite upholder, that furthest end of the Father, furthest point from the first center of the Father's nature, which is upholding at the infinite level, really above the level of Father and Mother, in a sense, and below that, you have that whole direct upholding of the Mother, in coming down in parallel to the sevenfold. So, by saying upholder, you're dropping down from the infinite upholder to the eternal Mother Son, that next level of upholder down. And they're purposely using that expression, pointing out that as far as we can understand that upholding, it's just a spirit upholding. That upholder is doing, the eternal Mother Son. And then notice how carefully they word this. They also bring up the Isle of Paradise, and they say, which so magnificently upholds all things material. And you're thinking, well, aren't they, saying that the Isle is an upholder too? No, notice they didn't say upholder, because it's not a being. They said upholds. I mean, there's obviously a parallel phenomenon there, but it's, the isle is not an upholder, even though it's upholding, okay? So, all very carefully worded there. Chris, yep.
If the Isle of Paradise, if it's in every ultimatum,
Its influence is at the center of every automaton. Yeah, it's, you know, it's outside of space and time, remember, so you can't think of it as literally being, you know, I can't reach and grab, you know, pinch it like this. It's not in space and time, but its influence enters every point in space and time and provides a center point for everything to be. You know, like if an automaton is this little spherical fact, it needs something to center it about, you know, into a sphere. It needs a central point of focus.
But wouldn't that be the reason why we can pray and why we can feel contact with God? Is because the Owl of Paradise?
No, they're going to talk about prayer. We talked about that a while back, that the Universal Father, or maybe I should say God the Father, not so much as the Universal Father, but as the Universal Controller, is directly engages the aisle, and hence through that avenue directly engages every automaton within us. So there's an intimacy there of the Father's contact that's separate from his contact through the personality circuit or through the adjuster, okay? I purposely brought that up for the reason you're saying. I mean, it's a nice way of sort of really thinking of yourself as being, you know, just literally every automaton is directly known by the Father. Every automaton of you is directly known by the Father. And so there's an intimacy of knowing that the Father has.
That's the physical part of reality.
Right.
Matter part of reality.
Right. So, you know, he in a way he has a hold of that bottom level, if you will, you know, of your nature, the literal matter of your body, and then the highest thing, the personality circuit. And then there's a whole bunch of stuff that's happening in between. And think about how, you know, that whole bit about him freeing himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity, really pulling himself out. So you exist in this whole in-between area, and he's encompassing you in a way. So he's on both boundaries of you. You know, it's a real kind of encompassing phenomenon. So it is a helpful thing to kind of bring in to think about the Father's relationship through the aisle. Yeah?
So they reference the Son three different ways.
Oh, uh-huh.
Paradise Son.
Yep.
Eternal Son. And the
Original Son.
Absolute Son.
Yeah, the original Son, too. He also,
so far.
Yeah.
And then just Son.
Oh, like you said, there's also the original Son at the very beginning of the...
Oh, are these three different facets of the
Son? No, I mean, most of the time here we're... you notice the title is Relation of the Eternal Son. So most of the time we're really thinking about the individuality viewpoint and...
Prose, I mean, so that they don't get boring.
No, not.
Same thing over and over and over.
I mean, that's the last thing that you would want to suspect. You know, it's better. Like Sydney, I know, is thinking this. I mean, it's like, well, okay, so why did they say Paradise Son there, and why did they say Original Son instead of Eternal Son? Those three are just synonyms, but it's depending on what they're wanting to stress. Are they wanting to stress the eternalness of that individual, or the fact that he stands in the stasis of paradise, so that he's an absolute anchor point, or that there's a whole descending order of suns that all originates in the original sun. Yeah, see, it all depends on what part of it they're invoking. Yeah, very nuanced. Yeah, yeah. And you can certainly ask that question. It's like, why did they start it out with the original Son is ever concerned? Well, it's all about the relation of the eternal Son to the universe. You know, and we know that that's the, you know, one of the really profoundly significant aspects of the Father's relationship to the universe is that there's a descending bestowal of sons that literally comes down and 2,000 years ago stood on this planet. Okay. So, you know, it's not surprising that that would be the first thing that they would invoke in a paper entitled Relation to the Eternal Son to the Universe, you know, where you're hoping, well, what does the Eternal Son have to do with me? I mean, we're going to touch on spirit gravity, which is one thing, but that's a pretty impersonal way that the Eternal Son has to do with you. You know, the really personal way is the very first thing they invoke, the original son of this descending sequence of sons. So, I mean, I can just say definitively, that's why the Divine Counselor chose that first, to put that foot forward first. Let's see. So, and then, you know, then they reiterate in the third paragraph, the Eternal Son is the actual upholder. Okay. Now, having, you know, really driven that home by saying it twice in two paragraphs, they go into that whole little thing about, however, don't start immediately thinking that just because you have this being, an infinite being, who is upholding all spirit things, that implies that spirit substance, whenever engaged, is innately, absolutely divine. If for no other reason, the big one they brought up there, you know, the spirit substance of Lucifer's body, for instance, you know, has been put into his free will control, and it didn't get controlled very well. You know, and so when you engage that blob of spirit substance, you're not engaging anything that's innately divine. You know, that spirit substance has been directed to iniquitous expression. Yeah. You know, so that's a really extreme example of how just because it's spirit substance, it doesn't mean it's innately divine. I mean, it very may well be being directed by will, free will, in very non-good ways. But then on top of that, I mean, just taking personality out, they don't really bring it up right here immediately, but just to taking personality out of the picture, free will out of the picture, spirit substance is part of the evolutionary universe. So, you know, at a given point in time prior to the perfection of the grand universe, that spirit substance, if you look at it, you're not going to see something that represents supreme perfection. It's perfecting. Matter of fact, you know, remember, that's what we've come to recognize. What's the, you know, sort of the technical definition of growth? Perfecting spirit. I mean, if spirit was innately divine, that would be a nonsensical statement. There wouldn't be perfecting spirit. There couldn't be perfecting spirit. Hence, there couldn't be growth. The only way that there can be growth is because spirit is not innately divine. You know, so that's how completely turned around your whole worldview is going to be if you start with the assumption that the spirit substance is innately divine. You actually are severing yourself from the fact of growth.
Perfection of personality.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, I mean, perfecting spirit leads to progressing mind. Now, you're not, you can really not yet have used your personal self to begin to manifest a perfecting spirit nature and a harmonizing selfhood. You could be just down there in the higher levels of your animal origin mind, with a quote-unquote progressing mind. But the problem is that progression true or false? You know, there's false progress and true progress. Remember, change without growth is potential evil. You know, if you take this perfecting spirit and the harmonizing selfhood out of the picture, and you just try to start with progressing mind and take it down through adapting life to varying things to change, what's to ensure that that progressing mind is righteous, that it's conformal with the cosmos? Nothing. Matter of fact, it's basically a zero probability that it's going to be conformal. Okay, you know, and but you know, you've got the, you know, you've recognized the notion of progress, and you're immediately assuming all progress is good, and you know, then begins a lot of problems for everyone.
Inner life is good.
So,
but don't you have to create forms in your mind that'll make for the capacity for spirit to come down?
Right. I mean, we all know that we're built from the, you know, the adjutants one at a time until the seventh adjutant. Yeah. You know, and then you can have an encirclement in the Holy Spirit, and personality can engage it, and you know, there can be a progressively personalizing self. But yeah, I mean, so it's just a, you know, it's just a matter of not calling the upper reaches of the mind, which could have a really spirit-like flavor to them, and the adjutant mind spirits, after all, you know, that those upper reaches of progressing mind could have a real unity sort of flavor to them, but it's just the self, technically. Spiritual levels of self, you know, can be in play in the absence of any real cosmic levels of a personal self. Okay? And that's a mistake that many, you know, new discoverers of spirit make. It's like, okay, I'm pretty sure I have a hold of something that's unity-like, and yeah, you do, but that's just the beginning. You know, now you have to make sure that that gets directed properly, and that requires going not just one notch above that progress, you know, that potential for progressing mind, but two notches. You need to take it all the way up and reflect off of the cosmos, and then get that down, you know, coming down through, so that there's a top-down imposition of righteousness on that system.
A lot of people can get into, can have a glimpse, I think, of the Almighty Supreme, because it's got its own equilibrium.
Right, there's...
Does that make sense?
Right, I mean, they're, you know, both the Almighty and the Mother are subtle facts, but there will be a tendency. Remember up there, you know, towards the end of the Supreme Papers, you had that section about providence?
Yeah.
And we were noticing that they were, you know, providence with a lowercase p, yeah, you know, is really tied to the functioning of the Almighty. In other words, to that subtle summation, you know, collective character that you begin to get a sense of, you know, that there's providence afoot, right. You know, okay, but
you start to see patterns, and particularly in nature,
right. But
there's this recognition of,
but higher than that is providence with a capital P,
right? The over control, as opposed to the control.
Mother, you know, yeah. You know, so that you, you know, we know that they work together in perfect synchrony to end up with this power personality synthesis that is the supreme. But yeah, I mean it, I mean that's kind of related to what I'm saying, that you can begin to get this sense that you've reached your destination when you start to get the first inkling that your mind feels a bit unity-like. You know, we know that humans always, I mean, the first time humans ask, you know, it's like, wait a minute, there's something that's subtle there, I'm going to call it beauty, there's an initial tendency to personify that and turn that beauty into God. You know, beauty comes from God, God is beautiful, but beauty's not God. You know, in the same way here, you know, that first inkling of spiritual levels in your mind, the upper levels of your mind, is not even literally spirit, let alone God, for the father or the mother. You know, because now the above that level of progressing mind, you know, is this domain that initiates the higher process, the domain that's related to the Father. The Father said, "Be you perfect, even as I am perfect." And so there's this domain of perfecting spirit. He's the spiritual Father. And so there's this domain that you initiate its motion, that ing of perfecting. You initiate the motion there by consecrating your will to the will of the Father. But even that is not an end in itself. The Father is the initiator. So by you consecrating your will to his will, you've joined in the initiation. The initiation of what? See, this should be the next question in my mind. What, you know, in your mind, what have I initiated? What did he want me to initiate? He wanted me to initiate a dynamic relationship that can only result as a consequence of that, a harmonizing selfhood. The personality is there, you know, as that harmonizing influence. But you still have a, you know, you have to consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. And you can only do that because the Father first gave you, you know, the ability to consecrate your will. You know, one must be something first, but then one must do something as well as be something. The Father is not an end in himself. If the Father was an end in himself, all there would be is the I am. Father's not an end in himself. And so your relationship to the Father is not an end in itself either. It's the beginning of something. The beginning of something grand. The beginning of something that wasn't in the I am. A harmony of many.
Yeah. That's how the Mother Spirit came into being, was from top down. So he's like the first of the Mother Spirits that come down.
The Eternal Mother, Son, and the Infinite Mother Spirit, you know, are initiated together. And they both embody upholding motherness. And together, you know, see, there's, you have both the Eternal Mother, Son, and the Infinite Mother Spirit, and it's through the two of them together that you can have the whole hierarchy of mothers.
Yeah, so that's, you
know,
right then, that
well, see, I mean, you know, directly the Creative Mother Spirit, you know, the spirit part of the Creative Mother Spirit is not coming from the Eternal Son, it's coming from the Infinite Mother Spirit. See? So you can kind of think that potential for Mother Deity to become in association with the Creative Spirit and make it a her, make it a Creative Mother Spirit, that ability for Spirit and Mother Deity to come together is inherent in the Eternal, or the Infinite Mother Spirit, because that's the Spirit and Mother together, you know, as opposed to the Son and the Mother together. I mean, actually, there's mother character in the Creator Son that comes from the Eternal Mother Son.
Yep, that's
okay, and that gives rise to, you know, like he makes material sons and daughters himself.
Right. The
Creator Son does, because there's both father and mother nature within him, from the Father and from the Eternal Mother Son. So he can do that in and of his own nature. It's, you know, we're definitely not going to try to really get into the details of Mother Deity up at this high level. We're gonna get into it in the graduate level seminar that we're gonna do. That's what, because it's at that level, and you can't just sort of get into it. I mean, it has to be led up to. It's a very complicated thing. Okay, but you know, I'm just trying to touch on it. I mean, you know, you'll see as we keep going, it's here a lot. Okay, so let's okay.
Did the same divine counselor write all eight papers, the first eight?
You can. I mean,
I.
One can suspect either way. You know, it, I mean, you notice how this previous paper said, indicted by a divine counselor assigned to formulate this statement depicting the eternal Son of Paradise, you know, as opposed to the other ones, always, the previous five papers, it was always about the Father. It's like, well, maybe they're different divine counselors. You know, here it says, times almost without number I have stood in the divine presence of this eternal Son. That's a little bit different when the author of the Father Papers talks about, you know, he didn't sort of make it such a superlative statement. You know, he knows of that which he speaks, but you know, he didn't word it quite that way, of times almost without number. So, see, there's things that, you know, you might, maybe it's a different divine counselor. If I come across something that really pins that down definitively, I'll let you know. But I'm still kind of, you know, non-committal on that one. All right. Okay, so let's just, you know, so this spirit-gravity circuit, that, I mean, as long as we spent this much time talking about it, I mean, just, you know, when we talk about that spirit presence and this associated spirit-gravity, when you're really talking about the aspect of, you know, the quote-unquote eternal Son, that you're really going to think of as having a spirit presence and being, you know, directly tied to this phenomenon called spirit gravity, you're really not so much talking about just the eternal Son there. It's really the eternal Mother Son. It's that mother deity, that experiential deity that was added to the existential deity of the Son, that gave that being the ability to have this ubiquitous presence that we're going to read about now. So the ability to have, to not just be a transcendent fact, but to be a measure of, you know, intimate, you know, immanent, God as immanence, you know, fact. And just look at how they started up here in this next paragraph.
Everything taught concerning the immanence of God, his omnipresence, omnipotence, and omniscience, is equally true of the Son in the spiritual domains. The pure and universal spirit gravity of all creation, this exclusively spiritual circuit, leads directly back to the person of the second source and center on Paradise. He presides over the control and operation of that ever-present and unerring spiritual grasp of all true spirit values. Thus does the Eternal Son exercise absolute spiritual sovereignty. He literally holds all spirit realities and all spiritualized values, as it were, in the hollow of his hand. The control of all universal spiritual gravity is universal spiritual sovereignty.
Okay, so right at the end there, you know, they're literally using the hand, you know, illusion of upholding, which is just such an immediate thing to visualize, upholding as a hand. You know, and there it is. He writes, everything taught concerning the immanence of God. So, you know, again, you know, they're talking about God the Father there, see, you know, is equally true of the Son. That's what we were just pointing out. There is that lastly, the infinite upholder, that most remote from the first source and center fact of the Father, is where this immanence begins. There is an immanence to the Father, but it's only at the infinite level. You know, he's only the infinite upholder, upholding at the infinite level. You know, so, you know, that whole bit when we talked about, you know, going around the Father's circuit, and you have the infinite upholder, and then that which extends the infinite upholder through, you know, the infinite capacity. I mean, that infinite upholder, you know, is all through the infinite capacity. It's all at the infinite level only. So this immanence of the Father, like I said, I mean, and technically, the more you study and think about it, that immanence is above the level where the words Father and Mother really have direct meaning. You're clear up at sort of the God, the infinite, you know, sort of domain, not subsequent where you can really talk about the Father and the Mother. So it's, you know, it's not a very mother-like immanence. And it's completely at the opposite end from the thing that you really are focusing on when you're thinking about freeing himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity, that first source and center, getting himself out. So it's very important to immediately, you know, they're saying that's just not going to get it done, that very tenuous at the infinite level fact. Something has to be down sub-infinite that can really be God as immanence if there's going to be something to uphold all of you. Because you're not at the infinite level. And so the very first step in bringing that immanence really down to a consequential, you know, in a sense, within, not just within the infiniteness of the infinite upholder, the infinity of the infinite upholder. Okay, or the infinite capacity, not just within the infinity of the infinite capacity. Okay, so that this is that first step of that mother deity of the Son coming down. Okay, again, just stressing, that in terms of how we experience this presence, this is just going to be a spirit presence, this upholding. When you get down to the infinite mother spirit, then you talk about it being a spirit mind presence. So it's getting to be a little bit more like what we know the creative mother spirit to be as an upholder. And not surprisingly, the creative mother spirit is a direct, more of a direct downstepped expression of the infinite mother spirit than the eternal mother son. Okay?
This gravity control of spiritual things operates independently of time and space. Therefore, is spirit energy undiminished in transmission? Spirit gravity never suffers time delays, nor does it undergo space diminution. It does not decrease in accordance with the square of the distance of its transmission. The credits of pure spirit power are not retarded by the mass of the material creation. And this transcendence of time and space by pure spirit energies is inherent in the absoluteness of the Son. It is not due to the interposition of the anti-gravity forces of the third source and center.
And the word in there was circuits of spirit, pure spirit power. The very fact that it's, it's an absolute being here that has a presence is going to make it transcendent. I mean, you know, the Isle of Paradise too is not something that just enters space at one point and then diminishes as 1/r², as you move away. Or anything, is being diluted by, the surface area that you're spreading it over. It doesn't work that way because it enters every point simultaneously.
Does this go all the way to the end of space?
Let's really look at it the way those eternal beings look at it. When they look out at the universe, they see the cosmos infinite as a present fact. Okay. They don't actually see, a slowly developing grand universe and a not even, begun master universe. I mean, they see the cosmos infinite all done. They have an eternity viewpoint. So for them, the cosmos infinite is already all there. It's just our vantage point. From a time viewpoint and an individuality viewpoint rather than an eternity viewpoint and a unity viewpoint, if you can begin to appreciate it that, think of it as in a sense being all there and then you're just experiencing up through it.
So let's just go with that. Spirit realities respond to the drawing power of the center of spiritual gravity in accordance with their qualitative value, their actual degree of spirit nature. Spirit substance, quality, is just as responsive to spirit gravity as the organized energy of physical matter, quantity, is responsive to physical gravity. Spiritual values and spirit forces are real. From the viewpoint of personality, spirit is the soul of creation. Matter is the shadowy physical body.
Okay, a couple important things in there. One big thing they were stressing. So from our perspective, you know, we always talk about spirit substance, but, you know, we always have to remind ourselves that's mostly an abstraction from our current nature. I mean, it's not like I can literally, you know, pound my fist against spirit substance, you know, the way I can with matter. So, a way to start really thinking about its literalness is not so much as a quantity. It is a quantity, but that's going to be pretty confusing in many ways. So they say, you know, start with matter having, you know, its literalness being quantity and spirit literalness being quality. You know, so that spirit gravity, you know, you're initially going to be able to understand it not so much as grabbing hold of some quantity and pulling it like material gravity, you know, but grabbing a hold of quality and drawing it towards the center of that quality.
So spirit gravity is what takes you up to eternity.
Yeah, it's what draws you. So, and you'll see they'll, you know, expand on this. This is just, you know, they're just starting this. So, you know, to really try to understand it initially as in quality terms rather than quantity terms. And then, so they'll use, you know, statements like spiritual values, you know, really not so much thinking about, you know, sort of a literal quantity substance sort of a thing, but it's this quality of values that is really, you know, thinking of it as being grabbed and drawn to higher levels of value. Okay, and then from the viewpoint of personality, spirit is the soul of creation, matter is the shadowy physical body. And it's very important to notice that initial prepositional phrase and not just notice the rest of it and think, oh, it's just like the whole Plato notion, okay? No, it's just from the viewpoint of personality. Well, what is personality? Spirit pattern. So if you're going to view it from the viewpoint of personality, that top-down viewpoint, spirit pattern and great engaging spirit, you know, then the real substance, you know, I mean, like, you know, soul is a literal thing, okay? The soul of creation, you know, what's going to be very intimate and tangible is there at the top, and that matter stuff is going to seem pretty shadowy down there, you know? That's why humans, you know, like Plato, you know, have often thought that was the valid nature of reality, the true nature of reality, because you get that spiritual consciousness and you start seeing things like that. It seems a lot more, you know, getting more intimate with spirit seems a lot more satisfying than getting intimate with matter, you know. And so it's like, you know, I'm really just going to favor that. I'm going to really develop a favoritism, an ism for that, that point of view. Okay, and I'm not just going to think that it appears that matter is kind of shadowy from that point of view. I'm going to literally assume that there really isn't any substance to matter, that it actually is just shadow, you know, and all there is spirit. And, you know, that's how you go off into those different isms that kind of have that as an assumption. You know, so that's why I say, you know, from the viewpoint of personality, from that top-down viewpoint, it'll appear this way. But, you know, if nothing else, giving you the absoluteness of the Isle of Paradise and the absoluteness of the Eternal Sun together in one harmonious picture, you know, should help to temper that It's not like the sun is above the aisle, and the aisle is just a shadow of the sun. They're on the same absolute plane, and from the bottom up point of view, this is the substance, and the spirit is the shadow. They're both subjective points of view. Neither is the one objective point of view.
They talk about that there's actually coordinate these other absolutes of reality, and you have multiple absolutes,
right,
you know, in play, and that's where the triunities get in.
Okay, I mean that, you know, if nothing else in all that, I mean, just, you know, one of the last things you said there, the fact that there's multiple absolutes, I mean, you know, one of the first things that they try to do in the revelation, you know, that everyone notices right away that they're doing it. It's nothing subtle. The seven absolutes of infinity is a very in-your-face sort of aspect of the revelation. It's right there. It's pretty hard to miss that. You know, you have your eyes closed pretty tight, and you know, to read the book and not notice the seven absolutes of infinity somewhere. You know, that is that first effort to try to get you to recognize that there isn't any simple picture that allows you to understand infinity. Infinity is a big fact, and it's, you know, there's even when you're trying to understand the most fundamental aspects, there's quite a bit of complexity in play, and you just can't think simplistically. You know, especially in some simple linear simplicity that really ends up just being a dichotomy of spirit on one side and matter on the other, and spirit is real and matter is a shadow, and, you know, and all those sorts of things.
Just like these things, these amorphous intellectual things, they just vaporize, you know, when it comes to dealing with reality.
Right. I mean, definitely.
Because reality just pounds against
you. Right. Yeah. Okay. I mean, just you know, like, not to belabor this, but just
yeah.
I mean, just recognizing. I mean, you know, when we try to bring in all this complexity, you don't ever lose sight of how important the fact of spirit is in the picture. You know, if I try to re-emphasize matter, you know, in the face of recognizing spirit, it's not because I'm trying to downgrade the importance of spirit in the picture. I mean, what would lead to the harmonizing of individual things if there wasn't a fundamental unity, if there wasn't spirit? I mean, obviously, there's no means to that end of harmony if there isn't a motivating influence imposed on it that is unity. I mean, you're not going to turn individuality into literal pure unity, make its individuality go away. There's no drops of water. They're going to melt into an ocean. I mean, they're going to maintain their individual integrity, but there's nothing that would be any sort of a logical motivation for island universes to not continue to be island universes if there wasn't just as important a fact in play, unity. You know, so the only way that you can have both absolute unity and absolute individuality coexisting is by weaving them together into a harmony. Personality is spirit pattern. Yeah.
So eventually, we will harmonize with that personality that he created for us.
Yeah, that's certainly right. That's a valid thing. I mean, just the fact that you start out material and not spiritual just fundamentally means it's pretty hard for there to be a lot of personal self in play initially. It's just not possible. Yeah. You start out as a very shadowy fact. A seventh circler is a very shadowy fact in the eyes of spirit beings. Yeah. Okay.
The reactions and fluctuations of spirit gravity are ever true to the content of spiritual values, the qualitative spiritual status of an individual or a world. This drawing power is instantly responsive to the inter- and intra-spirit values of any universe situation or planetary condition. Every time a spiritual reality actualizes in the universes, this change necessitates the immediate and instantaneous readjustment of spirit gravity. Such a new spirit is actually a part of the second source and center, and just as certainly as mortal man becomes a spiritized being, he will attain the spiritual sun, the center and source of spirit gravity.
So you know what they did there? So they start you out with, you know, the seven absolutes of infinity, individuality viewpoint, and they designate this fact that we're talking about the second source and center, and then and they want to talk about this spirit gravity. See what they did there? They flipped the words. It's center and source, not source and center. It goes from father to mother. Goes from source and center to center and source. Okay? Now, so see, so just you know, now that we've figured that out, you know, they're just between the lines. They're reminding you that, you know, to really understand spirit gravity, you know, this spirit presence, you need to think of the eternal mother's son, not just that eternal son existential fact that you would call the second source and center. Okay? So it's just over and over. You see, they, you know, they say, you know, they're just feeding in these mother words.
The sun's spiritual drawing power is inherent to a lesser degree in many paradise orders of sonship. For there do exist within the absolute spirit gravity circuit those local systems of spiritual attraction that function in the lesser units of creation. Such sub-absolute focalizations of spirit gravity are a part of the divinity of the creator personalities of time and space and are correlated with the emerging experiential overcontrol of the Supreme Being.
Okay, so notice the mother things in there. Such sub-absolute focalizations. You know, a focalization is literally another word name for the mother-type deity. You know, the summation is the Almighty. The focalization is the mother. Okay? So, such sub-absolute focalizations of spirit gravity. It's like, oh, okay, so I have sun-type deity in the Creator Sun. So that's how that literal spirit gravity focus point, you know, or anchor point, I probably should say anchor point, it is brought down from the eternal sun to the local universe, but he doesn't do it the whole process all by himself. It's a coordinate process. So you know, he is the spirit gravity, but there has to be a focalization of that spirit gravity. The mother deity, the creative mother spirit, were, you know, and the spiritual drawing power of the sun, the creator sun, work together to make a local spirit gravity thing happen. So, see, it's further clues about what happens when, you know, and you say, well, why couldn't he just do it by himself? We were just talking about how it's the eternal mother son. Isn't there mother nature? Well, see, they're pointing out that's one of the reasons why it takes a creator son and a creator mother spirit. Because when you downstep the type of mother deity that's in the eternal mother son, you don't get something that has this space presence sort of nature that's needed. And so that it requires the creative mother spirit to be in league with this. And we've talked about that. He can't just bestow the spirit of truth all by himself because he can't manifest as a not conditioned by space fact, ubiquitous fact. You know, only she can. Okay, you know, that whole hand, that upholding hand, he can't actually manifest as a substrate upholding hand like that. She can. So he can do kind of an internal mother-like thing where from within him can get, you know, he can give rise to material sons and daughters, but he can't externalize that mother impact. So there's like a, he has a mother-like intent, but he can't really manifest as a mother-like extent. See, so there's little subtle clues if you think about it. You got these two different types of mother deity that are getting downstepped from the eternal mother son and the infinite mother spirit. And they have limitations, you know, and differentials even when they get downstepped. And the two have to work together to make this happen. So, and you only sort of pick that up when you know that you're not going to use the word focalization for the Creator Son. You're going to, that's describing the Creator Mother Spirit. But the Spirit Gravity, you know, is the Son. So the two are, those two are actually together between the lines of that sentence. And then, you know, they sort of take it all the way up to the total finite. Notice how they, and are correlated with the emerging experiential over control of the Supreme Being. Okay. Over the cosmic over controller. That's the Universal Mother. You know, this emerging experiential. Yeah, so, I mean, you could, instead of saying with the emerging experiential over-control of the Supreme Being, you could say with the over-control of the Universal Mother. So, you know, and it's only once you started to put all this together that we could see that that's what that's, you know, really alluding to. That transcendent fact of he-ness that is the Supreme Being is not down here in some sort of way like this, ubiquitous way, presence way like this.
So, Chris, where would the spirit gravity be? I mean, like,
okay, so gravity, you think, right. So that's why it's very important to, like you said, don't initially try to understand it in quantity terms, so that it, you're literally going to have a blob of something that's going to move through space because of it. You want to think of it in quality terms. So the quality of your spiritual nature, it feels a gravity. There's going to be an influence, you'll feel an influence imposed upon you that will be tending to draw that quality to higher levels of quality, higher spiritual levels, from low level quality to higher and higher levels of quality, more and more valuable spirit. Okay, that's what's being drawn up by spirit gravity, is the quality of your spiritual nature. It's not literally pulling you up off the floor.
Okay. But maybe inside you're being pulled.
Right, but inside, you know, when we talk about the material mind and the literalness of material gravity in your material mind, we often visualize that in a direct spatial way so we can think of spirit gravity pulling stuff down into, you know, and you're depressed when you let it pull you down and stuff like that. Material gravity, oh yeah, okay, that material gravity pulling you down. But now technically, I mean, you know, literally, it isn't like you can't hold your head up because, you know, it's pulling your material mind down to the floor. Okay, you know, so what's literally happening? Well, there's a, instead of the unity, you know, in contrast to the unity being drawn upward by spirit gravity, the individuality is being drawn downward by material gravity. You know, so material gravity is tending to pull you away from unity, you know, and get you more and more into an island universe individuation mode. Okay. And you don't want to go all the way to a lonely individuality, because then you become depressed. You know, you feel disconnected from everything. You also don't want to totally let spirit gravity diffuse you into, you know, a formless bliss, because then you're so heavenly minded you're no earthly good. God wants to use your hands, you know. He doesn't want you to so draw away from that you don't have hands anymore. You need some individuation. You need fingers. Only arms can hug.
Dynamic service.
Loving service. See, so loving service is a balance between material gravity, making sure that you have individuality still so that you can serve, and spirit gravity, you know, giving you enough of an inner exaltation that you you know, have an inspiration of love behind that service.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Quantity and quality.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so you're in you want to find an equilibrium between the spirit gravity and the material gravity.
To do something, you have to focus.
Right. And the unity of spirit is the antithesis of focusing. You know, right. Everything all blurs into one. You know, if you just let spirit gravity totally have the final say. Yeah, you'll your children will fade from your view. Everything will fade from your view, and you'll just, you know.
Is spirit gravity what brings you into like a spontaneous worship mode?
Yes, spirit gravity draws you up so that you can grasp what's up there. You know, you're given a personality that has fingers that can grasp spirit, unlike these fingers. My personality has fingers that can grasp spirit, grasp a hold of unity. And again, the point is to recognize that's not an end in itself. Don't just grab it and stay there. Now do something with it. Don't just be with it. Do something with it. You know, and what you do with it is you bring it down into service. You know, take that unity substance that you now can get a hold of and make it serve, you know, mankind, serve the greater good. You know, if you can, you can't serve the greater good if you have no relationship to unity. You have to bring unity down in to individuality. Yeah, that whole bit of, you know, that's, so, I mean, that's a way to initially understand the purpose of the Eternal Son in getting you going. You need the Eternal Son and His spirit gravity to draw you up to go, whoa, what's this stuff? Recognize that, ooh, this could really be useful. Let me grab a hold of this, and then let me come down off the mountaintop and go to work with this. Just use this. Okay? But if you didn't have the Eternal Son, you know, there would be nothing would draw you up there. You know, you're clueless. You don't know there is such a thing initially. So you'd never go up there, you know. So you're drawn up there and brought into, you know, face to face with it. And then the challenge is to not, you know, want to build a tabernacle there and stay there forever like the apostles did. You know, they wanted to stay on the Mount of Transfiguration forever. No, you know, Jesus said, no, we take a hold of this and now and we take it down and we do something with it. That's the whole point. They wanted to just stay up there and blissing out in that incredible spiritual experience. Yeah.
And that's understandable.
Yeah, right. It's very understandable. But you know, that's why it's you need to challenge yourself.
Yep. Got a great quote.
Okay.
From Paper 100, Section 3, the first sentence: "Religion is not a technique for attaining a static and blissful peace of mind.
Mm-hmm.
It is an impulse for organizing the soul for dynamic service."
I mean, that's why I always use that word "blessed" because of that sentence. I mean, you know, you could think of using that word "blessed" because it's such a common thing of, you know, blissing out in the spirit. You know, but they try to anchor that, you know, in that sentence right there. I mean, that's what we're talking about. It's not an end in itself.
Can I read the second sentence? It is the enlistment of the totality of selfhood in the loyal service of loving God.
Yeah. Yeah, the totality of selfhood, all dimensions of the selfhood. Okay, so anyway, meanwhile, back to noticing all of the little clues about that we're talking about the eternal mother son here, the mother. So we had this center and source. What else do we have here? Oh, and we had the focalization, that's right. Okay, now what else do we have?
Spirit gravity pull and response thereto operate not only on the universe as a whole, but also even between individuals and groups of individuals. There is a spiritual cohesiveness among the spiritual and spiritized personalities of any world, race, nation, or believing group of individuals. There is a direct attractiveness of a spirit nature between spiritually minded persons of like tastes and longings. The term kindred spirits is not wholly a figure of speech.
Okay. On first blush, it seems like, they italicized kindred spirits because they wanted to really stress that. This is another one that's, another thing in play. Kindred spirits only occurs twice in the book. So just like we saw before with a thing that occurs twice, and the first time it occurs, it's italicized, kind of encouraging you to search for it. You know, you probably remember, and some of the others might remember as well. Where do I find the other occurrence of kindred spirits? Paper 16, section 6. And when I go there and I find kindred spirits again, I find a singular reference in the book, kindred minds. Okay, and where am I? I'm in paper 16, section 6. I'm being introduced to the three cosmic intuitions in the Holy Spirit, the gift from the creative mother spirit, and I'm reminded of just what I was, that whole bit again, the fact that it's one thing to consecrate your will to the perfect will of God the Father and begin to experience others who've done likewise, and you recognize them as kindred spirits, but that's not an end in itself. That's an initiation for something greater. What is it? So you follow the clues. You follow to the other place where kindred spirits occur, and right there's the answer. You're kindred spirits so that you have the potential to be kindred minds. Because it's only when you're kindred minds that you'll have the brotherhood of man and peace on earth.
Yes.
It's only through first consecrating your will to the Father's will and then consecrating your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. I mean, peace on earth, brotherhood of man, that's harmony on earth. Okay?
It doesn't mean they have to agree.
The earth has to look like her harmony for there to be the brotherhood of man. We have to consecrate ourselves to being like, to making our minds like her. Not just our spirits like him. We have to be kindred minds. We have to be on the same page mindily. We have to, all of the basic things have to be collectively self-evident. Argument doesn't even enter in. There's nothing to argue about. Let's argue about whether or not the sky is blue or not. No, it's just self-evident. It's blue. Okay? If as long as we aren't kindred minds, things are not gonna be self-evident, and we're gonna be arguing. There's not gonna be peace on earth. Kindred spirits is just the potential. The Father is the initiator. He potentializes what? He potentializes, the actuality of kindred minds. Yep.
Chris, you said have to. That's a willing, a cheerfully willing
yep.
have to.
Right, it is, right. You have to choose.
Positive.
We're not going to be made kindred minds by fiat. We have to choose. Each of us must choose to take it to the next notch, to not stall out when we first discover that faint flicker of faith relationship with the Father, and go there. I've reached the destiny. I mean, think about how reaching the Father is not the destiny in the grand scheme of your finite career. It's the end of the first half of your finite career. You get to paradise and the Father and become a finality. Okay, you found the Father. No longer the faint flicker. It's the full fire hose right there.
I thought it was an infinite career.
Well, yeah, but it's a finite career. We're just going to talk about there's two halves of the finite career. We're not going to talk about the absent and whatnot career, but just two halves of that initial finite career. You know, so, you know, first you find the Father, but then you go out and do something. Because now you are something, then you're going to do something. And we know it's God the Father seeking and God the Mother revealing. The thing that follows, finding the Father, is mother-like. Now, see, just notice that the exact same pattern is just repeated over and over again. In all ways, at all scales. That's why it's easy to understand the revelation. Because there's just a few basic things to recognize. And then it's just... Because there's one source and center of all things and beings, the pattern just gets repeated over and over. You can just use the same understanding over and over.
Can I read the little phrase that you were talking about?
Sure.
Okay, it's very nice for everyone. It says, the fact of the cosmic mind explains the kinship of various types of human and superhuman minds. Not only are kindred spirits attracted to each other, but kindred minds are also very fraternal and inclined towards cooperation, the one with the other. Human minds are sometimes observed to be running in channels of astonishing similarity and inexplicable agreement. Right. It's totally harmonious.
Yeah, it's harmonious.
Right. From a bottom-up point of view, it's inexplicable. You know, it's a piece that passes all understanding. It's inexplicable, see?
See, he was spirit. It was just the word attracted to one another.
Right.
But then, with mind, there was all these other things
right. That
were of, like, you know.
Right. And just notice, I was just going to point that out. You know, just notice that right, you know, the two things right there. It's one thing to feel that spiritual attraction.
Yeah.
That doesn't get you, brother to man. Yeah. You know, notice, after they say that, they say fraternal.
Mm-hmm. Fraternal.
The brotherhood of man.
I know people that I feel a spiritual kinship to, but mindfully, we have a real difficult time.
Right, and why is that? Because it's sad to record. I mean, there just isn't enough objective mind functioning on the planet for there to be the brotherhood of man. You know, if it wasn't sad to record, then the brotherhood of man would already be manifest. Brotherhood of man is not manifest because it's sad to record. You can't get the brotherhood of man with adjutant subjective mind.
Right.
You know, the best you can get is similar genetics leading to similar subjective mind and little pools of common subjective mind who all have one common ideology.
Camps, I think
they're called. Camps, right.
Factions,
you name it. Right. It's just... Yeah, and it doesn't matter how much you use your ability to wish, your spiritual consciousness, to wish that subjective puddles will be one unified ocean, it's not going to happen. Harmony is not possible down in the lower domain of the hourglass. You got to get everyone up, you know, at the common cosmos level.
Least enough of a group
right.
that can start to redirect.
Right. You know on this planet that's what it's going to be. I mean, because
right.
we're so
right.
spread out.
Right.
Yeah.
Lucifer was peddling that stuff.
Right. Lucifer was peddling, you know, the illusion of, you know, a confederation
right.
of subjective puddles.
Right.
Okay.
So if you have two kindred minds working together on a project, each person is seeing the obvious that's evident for the higher good of the whole.
We hold these truths to be self-evident. If you don't have a critical group of people that can see the same thing, you know, that these truths are self-evident, that have objective consciousness. That's just, you know, we've talked about that many times. The notion of the United States is impossible with subjective mind, you know? And that's why things are starting to fall apart because everyone's going, well, there is no such thing as self-evident. There's my point of view and your point of view. But we have this common spiritual wishing. Let's just imagine that multiculturalism can, you know, is unity. No. Yeah. No. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Yeah, and that common harmony doesn't lie down there in that subjective differentiation. You have to get up into an objective commonality. All right, so let's see. All right, so there are the kindred spirits and kindred minds. And just, you know, again, besides all of that, just, you know, when they're talking about kindred minds, we're talking about the mother again. You just notice, I mean, just over and over again, we're picking up little things that are bringing in the mother. It's just all through this. Mm-hmm.
Like the material gravity of paradise, the spiritual gravity of the eternal sun is absolute. Sin and rebellion may interfere with the operation of local universe circuits, but nothing can suspend the spirit gravity of the eternal sun. The Lucifer rebellion produced many changes in your system of inhabited worlds and on Urantia, but we do not observe that the resultant spiritual quarantine of your planet in the least affected the presence and function of either the omnipresent spirit of the eternal sun or the associated spirit gravity circuit. All reactions of the spirit gravity circuit of the grand universe are predictable. We recognize all actions and reactions of the omnipresent spirit of the eternal sun and find them to be dependable. In accordance with well-known laws, we can and do measure spiritual gravity just as man attempts to compute the workings of finite physical gravity. There is an unvarying response of the sun's spirit to all spirit things, beings, and persons. And this response is always in accordance with the degree of actuality, the qualitative degree of reality of all such spiritual values.
Okay. Again, stressing this again, want to note that how that previous paragraph ended. Again, this combination of the omnipresent spirit of the eternal sun, that spirit presence, again, that presence of the eternal mother sun, see, and the associated spirit gravity circuit of that presence. Okay, and then notice how they're saying, now we told you for you to start to understand what's going on here, think in quality terms, not so much quantity terms. But, you know, they're not so limited. I mean, you can tell from the way they're talking here. And they're talking about calculating it and stuff. I mean, they see it in very literal quantity terms and in ways that we just can't even comprehend. And it's just as literal and mathematical, a factual phenomenon, you know, as, you know, determining the rate of acceleration of this cup as I drop it under the constant influence of gravity. I mean, it's that matter of fact to them. You know, like you're saying, in terms of, you know, they take a measure of spirit substance, you know, you bring it into existence, and then they watch what it does in relationship to the spirit gravity, and it does exactly predictable things. Spirit substance itself is just a completely matter of fact spirit. Literal thing that you can measure and predict. You know, it's the personality, the pattern that you can impose upon that that's not predictable. The substance itself is just a substance, okay? And it's, you know, I mean, I'm sure after the 100 trillionth measurement to see if it really is consistent, you know, it all got a little bit tedious to them, okay? I mean, the only reason I say that is I just want, you know, I want to help, you know, take their inspiration to get us to not over exalt the fact of spirit. There's a strong tendency amongst mankind for the last 2,000 years after the spiritual uplifting to over exalt spirit, to really turn it into a substitute for God. Okay, you think of it as just sort of a panacea. It's a complete lifestyle solution. Okay, I mean, for us, okay, there's just nothing that would motivate us to think of it as a complete lifestyle solution. You know, it's like you thinking that that cup on that table is a complete lifestyle. It's just a blob of matter. It's just really pretty matter of fact. Okay. Yeah. So that's why the relativists will stress these things. It's just a means to a greater end. It's not an end in itself. But it's a very tricky thing because it, as soon as you, unlike matter, when you bring spirit substance into play, you can have sophistry instead of just fallacy. Because, you know, it takes a lot of careful manipulation to make matter seductive, you know, to give it enough beauty that it's seductive, you know, to turn it into a bug light, you know, that you're drawn to. Okay. But spirit, you don't have to do anything to it. You don't even have to care. It just what it is as a raw substance is seductive and will suck you in so fast. And that's why it's so easy for people to take dead man's bones and white, you know, put whiting around them, you know, the whited sepulcher, okay, and deceive you. You know, if you have a spiritual consciousness, it's very easy to deceive you. Just a little, if I just throw in one little drop of spirit in the midst of a bunch of crap, you won't even see all the crap. The spirit will just suck you right in and you'll consume all the crap without even thinking about it. It's very seductive. And demagogues and, you know, I mean, Lucifer, they know this. They know it. They know for immature angels and humans and whatnot, it just takes a little drop of spirit substance and you're trapped. You know, they make the perfect bug light with it.
Sure.
Okay. And so that's why the revelations say, you know, you've got to remember spirit dominates mind, mind dominates matter. It's very powerful stuff. One little drop of it, you know, your little insignificant mind and matter are going to be totally dominated. You know, danger means, you know, the root means dominant, domination. You know, because that little bit of spirit can dominate. You know, and so you can't be just up at the level of spirit. You need to have gotten above the level of spirit. So you can not just be a master of matter. You need to be a master of spirit too. You need to have spiritual insight to see through this. You know, these sophistries, to not just fall for the spirit candy that someone has wrapped around something.
Balance.
You know? It requires you to really, to not just be a spiritual self. Mm-hmm. Once you make yourself a spiritual self, now there's real danger in play. You know, you can't stop there. You know, it's like stopping at the sixth adjutant and not going up to the seventh. You're in a no man's land, or there's just nothing but danger there. You gotta go through that, get above it, and, you know, have a personal self, not just a spiritualized animal origin self. So that you can master, and you are no longer, you know, prone to sophistry. You know, you want to start out being sophistry resistant and moving quickly towards being sophistry proof. Okay. You want to get enough above spirit that you can see through any attempt to use spirit to deceive you.
You'll have to serve two masters.
I mean, in this life, perforce you serve two masters. But, you know, I mean, that actually, you know, helps you with this problem I'm talking about. You know, what if you don't have to serve two masters anymore? What if there isn't material gravity trying to pull you down into the safer zone, out of that danger zone, that no man's land, or you're getting a little bit into the spirit but not above it yet? Gravity is there to help you right now. It's like, you're not ready for that. Let's drag you back down off the mountaintop here, because you're getting a little fanatical and a little bit dicey, okay? But in the next life, you don't have that material gravity. You know, you don't serve two masters in the next life. You have to be all the more on your game. Remember, those that didn't have the help of material gravity during the rebellion had higher percentages of getting sucked into the rebellion. Mm-hmm. You know, the less material gravity that was kind of keeping them down and safe they had, the higher the percentages of that fell into the trap. Yeah. So, you know, it's just a little reminder. Once you don't have that aid of material gravity and you're up there just floating in, you know, in this very fluid domain, you're going to have to really be on your game. You're going to have to be the master of this, because it's going to be able to carry you away really fast.
And the angels, wasn't it the administrative seraphim that were most particularly...
Right, you know, I mean, because the angels, you know, are so susceptible, they don't have a very high objectivity, but, you know, they're very fluid, sort of, and easily manipulated. That's why they're so dependent upon their leaders, you know, so that they don't go astray. So if the leader goes astray, you know, it's lemmings. They just all go over the cliff.
like a magnet.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why it was just so catastrophic. But, you know, if you're not such a spiritual lemming, you know, just for no other reason, you got this boat anchor of material gravity pulling you down. You know, it's harder for Lucifer to drag you over the cliff.
Amadon used that to good effect.
Yeah, Amadon. Yeah, little old lowly Amadon. He's going, well, I'm glad I was. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He was solidly grounded, yeah. We've got to notice that last little bit there. You know, so, okay, so they're reminding us of the qualitative thing, you know, with the degree of actuality, the qualitative degree of reality, of all such spiritual values. See, again, that's the main way they're going to try to talk about this, is, you know, just think of the value aspect as what's under the influence of gravity. Okay?
But alongside this very dependable and predictable function of the spiritual presence of the eternal Son, there are encountered phenomena which are not so predictable in their reactions. Such phenomena probably indicate the coordinate action of the Deity Absolute in the realms of emerging spiritual potentials. We know that the spirit presence of the Eternal Son is the influence of a majestic and infinite personality, but we hardly regard the reactions associated with the conjectured performances of the Deity Absolute as personal.
Okay, now, you know, there's a little bit of stuff here between the lines that's kind of subtle. I mean, they bring this up in the foreword, but remember how they're initially introducing things. You know, if you go up and read about God the Absolute in the foreword, they kind of introduce the notion of God the Absolute by just referring to the Deity Absolute. The point there is they're starting you with your individuality viewpoint, and in the individuality viewpoint, you don't have God the Absolute. You just have the three absolute actuals and the three absolute potentials, and the Deity Absolute is this reservoir for personalizable spirit substance. And so you think about it as much more closely tied to something that you might think of as an actor, you know, and doing things. Okay, but what they're really referring to there, you know, we've been building up this about, we've got the mother going on, you know, in all these different situations. We know we also have the absolute upholder. We have God the Absolute as the absolute upholder. It's one thing, you know, so they're saying you have these two different absolutes that are in play. One that's an existential absolute, the eternal Son, and you have these very definitive, predictable, engagements of that absolute actual to spirit things. But within God the Absolute, like, you can think of it, you know, you start with the individuality viewpoint of the three reservoirs, and you bring the three reservoirs together into one, and you have the Absolute. Remember how we talk about it that way? You know, so if you think about it from the top-down point of view where I have God the Absolute, I can kind of think if I have this one aspect of God the Absolute is what came from this spirit reservoir, this deity absolute. And so there's this spirit fact of God the Absolute, which is likely to be this very significant influence on spirit as well. But unlike unlike the Eternal Son and his direct spirit gravity predictable influence, God the Absolute in no way, shape, or form is sort of, you know, an actual engaging us here at the finite level. This is a fact that's only an actual clear up there, the absolute level, and is going to be feeding down through the absonite and down into, filtering down into the finite is a very subtle and hence unpredictable thing because there's no measure of completeness to it. That's what they're really alluding to. Not so much literally the deity absolute, but this very subtle influence of God the Absolute as something that engages spirit coming down through all of this down to the finite and causing reactions that in spirit that they can tell have nothing to do with the Eternal Son because they know exactly what the Eternal Son is going to do to that thing, and it did that, but it did this other little thing too. Okay, and it's because of this influence of God the Absolute coming down. That's what's, you know, and so there's this subtle mother presence. Besides the mother presence of the Eternal Mother Son, there's this other absolute upholder mother presence that down in the finite here is a very unpredictable, subtle thing. That's what they're alluding to there.
Viewed from the personality standpoint and by persons, the Eternal Son and the Deity Absolute appear to be related in the following way. The Eternal Son dominates the realm of actual spiritual values, whereas the Deity Absolute seems to pervade the vast domain of potential spirit values. All actual value of spirit nature finds lodgment in the gravity grasp of the Eternal Son, but if potential, then apparently in the presence of the Deity Absolute.
The gravity grasp of the Eternal Son, as he was sort of unspoken, there's this other grasp. They can tell something else is subtle, is grasping it. You know, it doesn't just go in this direction that the pull of the Son's gravity would move it. It goes that direction plus a little bit, you know, goes in the Y direction plus a little bit in the X direction. And so it goes at this diagonal. There's another orthogonal influence, independent influence pulling on it. And it's so subtle, like they're saying, down here in the finite, that it's hardly even describable as something that's pulling on an actuality, but more on a potentiality. But again, from an eternity viewpoint, there is no difference between potentials and actuals. See, so from the vantage point of God the Absolute, because it's the mother, you know, aspect we're talking about, you know, she is pulling on an actual. But we're not going to see that. We're going to see something that seems to be like somehow pulling on the potential before it's an actual. And so the way that when you actually actualize spirit, it doesn't behave quite like you thought because it was like it was pre-pulled, sort of. See? It was pulled on before it could have been pulled on. And so as soon as it could have been pulled on, it not only did what you'd think, but it did something else too that doesn't seem to come from anywhere. They're saying it in this kind of fuzzy way because it's obviously not very logical to think of just this reservoir of spirit energy as doing anything. I mean, you got to have a you have to have God, you have to have a person if there's going to be an action. So that's why I'm bringing up all this other stuff so that you can kind of see. You know, the actor is actually God the Absolute, you know, and you can't get a more subtle, you know, mysterious actor than that, you know, acting on the finite. very removed fact. Okay. But, you know, they're saying, you know, no matter how, even though the God of the Absolute is extremely removed from the finite, the consequences are measurable. Not to us, but to them, who know the 28th decimal place of what the eternal sun does to a blob of spirit. You know, they can see there's another thing going on here, and there's no visible strings pulling on it. Yeah. Okay.
Spirit seems to emerge from the potentials of the deity absolute. Evolving spirit finds correlation in the experiential and incomplete grasps of the supreme and the ultimate. Spirit eventually finds final destiny in the absolute grasp of the spiritual gravity of the eternal sun. This appears to be the cycle of experiential spirit, but existential spirit is inherent in the infinity of the second source and center.
Okay, so you have the finite upholder, the absolute upholder, the absolute upholder. You have all three of these mother presences. But they're saying, you know, from their high point of view in studying the finite, they see, you know, they see the finite upholder and the absolute upholder, you know, in a more definitive way. They can understand how those are actuals that are coming down from above. But they're pointing out that they really can't understand the absolute upholder in that way. It seems like it doesn't really come down from above. It seems like it comes up from the bottom as the deity absolute.
Yeah.
See?
It seems like I'm
hearing right. That. Okay. And this is, there are other things that we'll be studying as we go forward in the book that have this sort of character. Let me just do one little quick analogy to this. When you talk about force and energy and power, and that, you know, and you think about that in kind of a potential, actual, real sequence, and that initially, you know, seems, you know, reasonably understandable. But the more you think about it, the more a little bit confusing it gets because you have this, when you're talking about power, like atoms, you know, when you're talking about mass, you know, it's very definitive, very localized. And then when you go sub-electronic, it starts to lose its definitiveness. It doesn't seem like it's sort of the source of definitiveness. The definitiveness is starting to go away. Now it's not power, it's just energy, and it's not quite as localized and solid-like. And then you go all the way down to force, and now it's really intangible, so intangible that it doesn't even have any location at all. It's ubiquitous. It's the force charge of space. You know, and you talk about that as being the presence, you know, the force charge is an absolute motion that's imposed upon the finite domain and you're experiencing it. It's like, wait, just think about that a second. It's really like you've got some sort of lowest point that is, you know, the basic fact of an atom, say. And you really have, from that lowest point, if you go towards automatons or towards larger and larger constructions of atomic nature, it actually, it's not in a line. It's really more like that's the bottom point of a V. And what initially you tend to think of as the bottom, as the foundation, the force charge, and everything building up from it in this vertical structure, it's really more like you have something that's coming down, you know, really both ways, or coming down and then going back up again, maybe is another way to think about it. And this is kind of what you're seeing in the spirit here. You have, you can think of spirit here in the finite, and they're saying, and you can see how that goes up into the supreme and the ultimate, but it doesn't really seem to go up through the supreme and the ultimate to the absolute. The absolute is coming in this way. And then when you observe that, it really doesn't, you know, you really don't, I mean, you do seem to not really experience it in this V-like fashion, but as if it's the absolute influence is in the foundation. It's hidden in the potentials at the foundation. Okay. So both spirit and matter actually have this same characteristic. Okay, I know that's a little bit odd, you know, to think about, but
and I'm not thinking of the flash presence of the infinite spirit that never leaves me. Mm-hmm. Ever since we read that,
right? See, and that's the thing about that thing that just exists, you know, like it's just this flash presence. You know, it's so definitive. But there's another absolute that's sort of just the antithesis of that. God, the absolute, is this very subtle thing that seems to be so different and fundamental than the supreme or the ultimate. And when we studied, like when we were up in paper 118 and we were talking a little bit more about the supreme and the ultimate and the absolute, the clue there is, you know, what is really fundamentally different about the two. You know, it's one thing to think of the supreme and you just keep on transcending and you get the ultimate, but and there's problems with that, but there's really a problem to just keep on going and get to the absolute. Because when you go all the way up there, it's not just more and more transcendent experiential deity. When you get all the way up to the absolute, it's now existential experiential deity. It's not just evolutionary experiential deity, transcendental experiential deity. It becomes existential experiential. You come back full circle, and the experiential engages the existential. And what they're pointing out here is, effectively, in terms of how that influences us, it's like it takes it from the top and puts it all the way back down at the bottom again, as a thing that sort of just exists in a very subtle, completely transcendent way, not so much above, but underneath everything. So that it doesn't even really seem like the absolute. It seems like this reservoir of potential called the deity absolute. You know, this spirit potency. Remember, the presence of the deity absolute is spirit potency, just like the presence of the unqualified absolute is space potency. It just seems like a potential. But both of those, you know, you put those two together along with the universal absolute, and you have the absolute. So that from the unity viewpoint, it's very different. So that's what that's kind of what's between the lines. It's sort of the higher level of this, is we really are talking about God the absolute and how that brings in this thing that doesn't seem at all like a direct phenomenon. It's something, it's an actual that's up at the level where there's no difference between potentials and actuals. And sure enough, we observe it at what we would call a potential. But see, it's really an actual, because it's from that highest point.
Maybe to know the mechanics of how all that works is a study of the triadic.
Yeah, I mean, the point here is not to somehow go, whoa, I get all those mechanics, I can write equations about that. The whole point is, I just wanted to, you know, extend that a little bit so that this just doesn't pass as like, well, I don't know what the heck that was talking about. What it's talking, you know, what it's alluding to is when things get really, really subtle, when you bring in God the absolute. I mean, remember when they talk about God the absolute, they tell you, even for them, it's such a subtle thing, they really can't figure it out. And I'm trying to just motivate a little bit for you why that is, why it's so subtle. You know, because it's God the absolute is a fact that exists when you start to transcend all these differentials that we use to understand things. You know, if I don't have potential and actual, I have a really time understanding things. If those two are one and the same thing, it's like, well, now nothing makes sense anymore. And that's why thinking about God the absolute is just so complicated. So I just wanted to bring a little bit more sense of sacredness, in a sense, into this, you know, into these inscrutable things. Because it doesn't sound very, it sounds pretty cold and factual, and you just talk about the deity absolutely is a reservoir for spirit substance. It's like, well, wow, that's just not, that's not very inspirational to me. But if you go beyond that simple individuality viewpoint and recognize what you really have is an insanely subtle hand of God, the absolute. You know, the spiritual expression of God, the absolute. In the same way that you could think of that space potency as the non-spiritual expression of God, the absolute. And a mind potency as being an expression of God, the absolute. There's this subtle thing that seems like nothing but potential, but it really is... this incredibly profound fact of God the Absolute. Even God the Absolute is here present and subtly influencing us. Things like what Pam brought up about bringing in God's connection through the automatons and through the aisle, you know, all these things that you can do to not have such a dichotomy viewpoint where there's spirit, and then there's that shadow stuff that I really don't care about. Matter. To remember it's all one thing. And no matter how you think about it, matter, spirit, potential, actual, from the right viewpoint, the right vantage point, it's all the same, just as definitive God engaging you. Deity engaging you. You know? Within and under and through and before and after and, you know, and in every way possible. That's the whole point. To see the whole of reality, just as being just as intimate and inspiring and personal, really, as that initial spark you get when you first taste spirit in your mind. To begin to have the same experience with everything is to begin to go beyond what the Father's initiation and to begin to be part of a cosmos. It's all, you know, now, the now of the cosmos is a divine dispensation, all of it, not just the spirit in it. Yeah. And so that's sort of the subtle, sort of super conscious thing that you know, what reason why they do stuff like this. It's just try to fill all of the potential places where you might go with a sacredness that you haven't recognized before. It's easy to call spirit sacred. You know, it takes a more sophisticated awareness of reality to call dirt sacred, you know, or to call something that's not even an actual, it's just a potential sacred. Okay. So we'll just keep on next time here with the Eternal Son, and this next section actually just expands on this a little bit more with the with actually some of this mother presence that we bring up when we talk about the parallel to the sevenfold. So let's just take a moment, reflect on that.